This is episode 365, dated Friday, June 21st, 2024.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everybody. Welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. Good to be here today. This is episode 365. Dated Friday, June 21st, 2024. Before we continue, let me introduce my friend and colleague, Peter O'Toole. Peter, how are you doing today?
We're doing fine. It's about 65 degrees and sunny and breezy and nice and cool. For those of you who are enjoying the heat, all I can say is I feel your pain.
It's a little muggy today in these parts. It's been in the 80s most of the week. We might get a little bit of rain today and tomorrow, but it's still muggy. Welcome to summer. By the way, happy summer, everybody. Before we continue, allow me to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with our media sources. Thank you for airing us when you do. We appreciate it. Also, to Tom and Lynn from Rosie's Place Chat Service, thank you so much for posting our programs. Also to Raymond Gay, our editor-producer, thank you for helping to make our shows a quality for our listeners to listen to afterward. We appreciate that as well. Finally, let me recognize Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions. She archives our programs on my website. Just go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down till you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on them. And you will be able to notice most of our archives from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I want to thank Nancy at this time. Nancy is our host for today's program. We appreciate you taking the time, Nancy, to help us out. And, of course, to Brad for streaming us on ACB Media 5. And because he does that, let me give out my email address for those people who may want to send us their thoughts on our shows. We always appreciate listener input. We do this for the listener, so we welcome input from them. BobBranco93@gmail.com. That's BobBranco93@gmail.com. We are here today with John Gamel. And John wears a lot of hats, folks. He is a reader of audiobooks. Many of you may recognize his voice if you take books out from the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library. He read for that organization a while back on numerous occasions. He is also a teacher. He's also a licensed private investigator. And he had been an agent for the FBI. You wear a lot of hats, John. Welcome to In Perspective. We appreciate your presence today.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, it's a lot of those things you mentioned as things that I do are things that I did. I was an FBI agent. I was a private investigator, and I did read for 14 years at Perkins. So it's you know, it's to a certain extent, it's ancient history. I've just moved along over various times, and of course now I'm not even in the Boston area anymore.
By the way, what did you teach?
Well, I taught at various points when I was both in the FBI. I was a firearms instructor. I was a SWAT team instructor. I instructed in various kinds of things like that. And then after I retired from the FBI, because they have mandatory retirement when you turn 57, I actually went to and taught in a Brookline public school, and I was the full-time building substitute in the Runkle School for 1 year. And essentially so I didn't teach a subject. I essentially, you know, taught the lessons that other people had created and had to be out for some reason. So that was what I did.
By the way, I'm starting to recognize your voice. I will say it this way, John. I think you were one of two readers who read my self-published book, My Home Away From Home, Life at Perkins School for the Blind. I have the feeling you were one of those two readers. That book was published around 2012. I believe you were working at the library then, doing audio.
Yeah, that does sound vaguely familiar. I think I think you're right, but I did so many over the years that, you know, I just kind of lost track of individual books, really. So.
Well, they provide a wonderful service, and we're very fortunate that you are a part of it. They're still doing quite well. They're still providing books. I love my digital cartridge player, and I love getting digital cartridges. I know that they've upgraded a little bit since then, but I cannot turn myself away from the faithful digital cartridges that they provide.
Yeah, I recall. I think I was that was something that was part of the process back then when I was there. I think they were just starting to do that at one point. I mean, we originally did reel-to-reel tapes, and then eventually it got very much more sophisticated over time.
Well, I first heard you on my CD copy. So you were doing CD at the time before the digital cartridge came on the scene.
Yeah, I think those were that preceded the digital cartridge, and I think I did those for a couple of years too. I did it for 14 years and then stopped.
So John, what are you doing these days?
Well, now I'm down in southern New Jersey, and you know, I came down here when I left Boston, the Boston area in 2022. Well, actually, toward the end of 2021, I still had a private investigative license, and I was still working as an investigator in the Eastern Massachusetts, Rhode Island area. Actually, Western Massachusetts also. I did some work out there. And so I came down here to New Jersey, and, you know, I looked into getting a private investigator's license down here, and the process was kind of cumbersome. And I decided that I would now be fully retired. So I essentially stopped doing that and, you know, didn't do any work as such once I got down here. But recently I've changed, you know, I've been doing various kinds of volunteer things over the years. And the most recent thing down here is I am about to become a court appointed special advocate for children. And so I'll be doing that down here after training. They've accepted I'm a pretty good guy, and so I will now be allowed to become trained to be a CASA volunteer down here. So that's my story.
And you're sticking with it, presumably.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm sort of intrigued.
How did you get? I'm sorry, Peter. I wanted ask John one quick question about the Perkins situation. How did you get to know about Perkins and their library and their services?
Well, I think it all started because I had a friend. My wife and I lived in Needham for 20 years, and we moved out of Needham and moved over to Brookline at a certain point. But we had friends that with whom we're still, you know, conversant and friendly in the Needham area, the Brookline area, and Eastern Massachusetts generally. And a friend of mine was a guy by the name of David Feldman. And David talked with me and said, you know, I need somebody to be part of the board for the MAB. And so I got to you know, become a board member. I was a board member for the Mass Association for the Blind for a period of time.
I'm very familiar with them.
And so I learned that Perkins had a recording situation. Now you didn't mention my prior to the FBI type of employment. I had been I after I got out of the Navy in the late 70s, I went to Boston University, got a master's in broadcast journalism, and so I developed what my friends always called the swell voice. And so I worked in television news and radio news for 7 years before going into the FBI. And I had learned that once I was part of MAB that there was this recording situation. And so I got involved in that and did that for 14 years. So that's how it worked.
What radio stations did you work for?
Well, the only radio station I worked for was WGAW in Gardner, Massachusetts. And that was, you know, would have been, you know, probably in 1971, 72, 73. And then I switched to WSMW TV down in Worcester, and I became, you know, I became one of the reporters down there and then did the anchor for a period of years. And it was from there that I went into the FBI and left broadcasting behind.
What prompted you to leave broadcasting behind for the FBI?
Yeah, well, here's how it worked. I was working as a reporter, obviously, and I got to working on the murder of a police officer in the town of Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, covering it as a story. And in the course of working on that story, I got to know a couple of FBI agents who were assigned to the Worcester Resident Agency of the FBI, and one of whom, after he got to know me and after seeing what I did on television, things like that, had a serious talk with me, and he said, you know, this FBI job's pretty good. You might want to look at it. So I did. I looked, you know, I started reading books about it and, you know, started understanding what it was really about. And I thought it would be pretty worthwhile for me. And so I applied, and it took a few years for me, for the Bureau to get around to hiring me. But then once I was hired, I was there for 22 years. So that's how it worked.
And what is let me ask the question differently. What was the FBI about then? And what do you think it's about now?
Well, I mean, you have to look at the fact that I retired in 2001. So I don't really, you know, I'm not really conversant with what the FBI is. I mean, I read the news the way everybody else does, but I'm not conversant with the FBI and the inner workings of it the way I used to be. Back then, it was really, for me, frankly, the best job in the world, because I got to do interesting things every single day, and I got to work with great, highly motivated people on dramatically useful things to do. And so it was really a perfect job for me. I always considered it to be the best job in the world. I couldn't have found anything better than that. So that's my present story. And what it is now, I have a nephew who is, strangely enough, I got him interested in the FBI, and now he became an agent, and now he is the special agent in charge of the whole office out in Honolulu. So, you know, but he doesn't tell me what they're doing these days. You know, that's I'm a has-been, so to speak.
The only reason
he's allowed to say that, he may not be allowed to tell you.
Well, that's just it, of course. You know, I might find out something, you know, reading the newspaper, but you know, but his name is Stephen, and Stephen's not going to tell me for sure.
So you briefly mentioned that at the FBI you were a firearms instructor, I think is what you said, and did a few other things. What was the most enjoyable part of the work you did? What made you like the FBI?
Well, essentially, what really is the best part? I mean, you know, you mentioned the firearms instructor and the SWAT team. Those are sort of like what I would consider to be, me in the Navy would call out a corollary duty. That's something you do to help, you know, everybody else, you know, and get along. The best part of being an FBI agent is really being able to look people in the face and have conversations with them. And that to me was the most important skill that, you know, a good FBI agent could have, which was essentially to be able to talk with people and understand what their motivations were and get to know them in a way that it possibly they didn't really want you to know, but, you know, but it was really just to find out things and pursue investigations and go from one step to another. And eventually I became, you know, as I mentioned, you know, before, a firearms instructor, simply because somebody thought I would be pretty good at that. And, you know, it turns out I was okay at that. I wasn't the best, but I was a good instructor because I could take time with people. And then I got on the SWAT team, and that satisfied my need for high intensity stuff. So, you know, so that's kind of like the way those things worked.
Did you ever meet the director?
I met, you know, not the director when I was working. The director was, you know, they changed directors a lot, and I never had anything to do with, you know, directors except for one. Let's see, who was it? It was years ago, and he was visiting town, and the SWAT team had to protect him. So, you know, that's the one time I met the director, but otherwise I didn't go to the office the way when Hoover was apparently the director. He met every FBI agent in the office and in his office at headquarters. And that was not going on when I was in.
I'm intrigued by the connection you've drawn between the work you did as a TV person and the work you did in the FBI, which is you talk to people about various things. What kinds of people did you talk with while you were at the FBI?
What kinds of things that I did?
What kinds of people did you talk with? Who did you talk with at the FBI?
You know, essentially, see if I can explain, you know, when you got up in the morning to go to work in the FBI, living in Needham, putting on the suit on every day, going in there, I was in the office from usually somewhere around 6:30 or 7 in the morning, ready to go to work. And the first few years I did background investigations and fugitive investigations. And the kinds of things you do on background investigations are substantially different than pretty much any other kind of criminal investigation, because you're just trying to find out whether or not somebody would be good material for the FBI. And you have to kind of get to understand whether or not people are being truthful with you, and, you know, how candid they are most of the time and things like that. So they started doing that for a few years. Then I started working on corruption of public officials, which when I started working in that area, people told me it was a growth industry in Massachusetts. And, you know, I had not really experienced that. I dealt with lots of elected officials when I was a TV news reporter, but, you know, I never really got into the whole, you know, corruption aspect. But then once I started working on corruption of public officials, I started to, you know, deal with people who were at the other end of the spectrum of candidness, so to speak. You know, they were liars, they were cheaters, and they were essentially many bad people. And that can carry on for a while. And I did that. And then I had an interim appointment for a couple of years when I was running all of the police training for police officers who would go to the FBI Academy for what's called the National Academy type training. So that was a completely out of the normal investigative work of the FBI. And then I switched into counterterrorism work, and that really brought me into the realm where I actually had to start developing informants and looking for people who were involved in things, who were quite willing to tell me about some of their friends or some of their not so friends. And that's the point, of course, in the counterterrorism field. And I did that for a while, and then right in the middle of that, in about 1990, I switched over to organized crime and started working on organized crime, and eventually became the Hoity Bulger case agent in the Boston FBI office, and worked with the U.S. Attorney's Office and other agencies working on the Bulger case. And then right in the middle of that, the man who was the supervisor of the organized crime squad retired, and I volunteered, raised my hand, so to speak, to be one of the people considered to be the organized crime supervisor. And I was made the organized crime supervisor in about 1996. And that's where I kept doing that until I, you know, it ended up in mandatory retirement in 2001. And that led to that statement that I always have for people, which is I had the best job in the world for 16 years as an FBI agent. Then I got promoted. So that's my story.
They still haven't resolved the Whitey Bulger murder, have they?
Oh, they did. Yeah. They know who exactly did it. You know, you mean in the jail where he was? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they know who did it, and they've charged three people, one of whom just pled guilty for it, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, essentially, I knew when Whitey was, I was out of the FBI, but I, you know, started to hear from friends of mine who were in the prison service, the prison system. You know, I got to know people in federal prisons, you know, over the years working, both working in and living in, so to speak, federal prisons. one of them said to me that they were about to transfer him to Hazleton. And once I heard Hazleton, that was a place that I had heard was a very dangerous place to be. And he literally was there for 12 hours and he got killed. So, you know, it was quite something. Anyway, that was it.
I am no means an expert on organized crime and prisoners, but my question based on what you just said is, if they want to keep a guy alive with lots of enemies, why would they transfer him to a really dangerous prison?
Well, I couldn't understand that myself, but you know, what happened was, I think, you know what, I started to understand what Whitey was like in prison. And I heard tales of that he wasn't a very, you know, he was not a model prisoner. He did supposedly, the words I heard, that he was not a model prisoner. He didn't get along with other people and he tried to get people to do him special favors. And so he ended up, being transferred from one prison to another at various points. And then he wasn't
a model citizen either.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm talking about once you're in jail, I mean, you have the opportunity to be quite nice, you know, and stay away from bad things, you know, depending on the jail, especially in federal prison. Federal prison is really quite, you know, not a, if you're going to do 20 years in jail, you'd best do it in a federal prison if you're going to do it. So, you know, that's the point. But, you know, he just ended up there because I guess he was not being well taken. He was not doing the good, being a model prisoner, so to speak.
I don't know what to say. I mean, it strikes me as do you think it was vindictive that they did this or they just ran out of place to send him? I mean,
there's only a lot of places you can send people with that level of intensity, so to speak, you know?
Sure.
So clearly I don't know. No one ever told me the background. Nobody ever told me anything about it, but I had always heard that Hazleton was not a great place to be.
So you talked about your work in as a SWAT on the SWAT team. You strike me as sort of a very low key kind of guy. SWAT people, my vision of them is they're pretty high, intense people. Talk about how you made that adjustment and what was it like to be on a SWAT team for you?
Well, the interesting thing about being on the SWAT team is that it's really made up of people who are very highly skilled doing various kinds of things. And they are not generally, at least in the FBI anyway, not generally their main thing is to be very well organized, to be sort of, to be able to bring intensity to an arrest situation, to be careful about things, you know, it requires a kind of like a wide ranging of personality. You know, you have to focus on the event. You have to focus on minor details of all kinds of things. And it can be an intense experience, which of course is what I enjoyed about it. We had people on the SWAT team who had been former hostage rescue team people for the FBI. The SWAT team leader when I was for many years was a former special forces guy who was, you know, in the Boston office. And so we had a group of highly motivated, highly, very thoughtful, very smart people who joined together and the training was always very intense. We did fast roping out of helicopters and things like that. Things that most people say, "What? You did that?" You know, it was just a very demanding but very rewarding type of thing.
And I would imagine that you'd need to have some degree of centricness to do that kind of work well and not get overwhelmed by it.
Well, I guess that would be the case, but it's, you know, it, I think what happens is that you train with a group of people. It's like anything involving a team. You train with the team and you understand the strengths and weaknesses of everybody on that team. And you understand how a team functions in a high intensity situation and you train repeatedly. I mean, we were, you know, I mean, to show you the kind of intensity, just one little aspect of it. You know, I think in the course of a year between the SWAT team and the firm's training and instruction that I did, I think I probably would shoot a gun maybe 10,000 times a year, you know, and just to get better and better and better and capable with that. And so that, I think, reflects the kind of intensity involved in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Along those lines, John, I can't help but wonder what the solutions should be in order to prevent mass shootings, especially in schools. I think about Sandy Hook, which is not far from where you were, and other shootings across the country. And what are your thoughts on prevention and control of these situations? And furthermore, why are they happening now more than ever before? I'm hearing theories about this, but what do you think?
Well, you know, I'm just as put off by them as you are. I have done some reading about how people are adapting schools in various ways, and I won't go into that publicly, but there are lots of people that are very focused on protecting schools from shooters. And I think the problem is that the guns, the AR-15 weapon, if you know what they are and if you've seen, you know, what you can do with them. And now, of course, if you look at the most recent decision about allowing bump stocks, which were used so disastrously by that shooter out in Las Vegas. I mean, the weaponry that people are facing is just really dramatically harsher than anything I ever faced way back in, you know, the 70s, 80s and 90s. They just, you know, things have changed so much with the weaponry and the accessibility of firearms. So, but I think people are working very hard on structures of schools and also procedures in schools, you know, of lockdown procedures and locking procedures to keep people out of schools and things of that sort. So I don't have any particular expertise in that, but I know people who do, and I know that they're working on those things.
Well, here's one thing that really baffled the heck out of me. You take a guy like Adam Lanza, who went on the shooting rampage at Sandy Hook. From what I understand, he obtained the AR-15 rifle from his mother. What would a mother be doing with an AR-15 in the first place? You know, never mind that Adam used it and went on a rampage with it. What was his mother doing with an AR-15 in the house?
Well, I don't have an answer for that. It doesn't make any sense to me.
It strikes me as, of course, this is a really complicated set of issues, but one of the issues clearly is a certain degree of mental illness that seems to be rifling through our culture. And, you know, when people get mentally ill, most people mentally ill are nonviolent, but there are the occasional people who are, and it's the results can be really terrible, of course. Talk about CASA. How did you get involved with CASA?
Well, it was kind of like in a backdoor type of situation. My wife is when we moved down here to New Jersey, my wife became part of a group called Impact 100. And some people may have heard of this already. Impact 100 exists nationally, and it's, you know, they're all over the United States that are this. It's groups of women who get together and contribute a certain amount of money, which they agree to each year to create a, I guess you would say, a fund for giving away to nonprofit organizations. And so she was working on there down here. She's done that now for 3 years, and she was working on the most recent event to give away the substantial amount of money that the Impact 100 people give. I think it's you know, like about $100,000 a year per each organization. So, you know, so with the, there's one here in, you know, Southern New Jersey, there's one in Eastern Pennsylvania and Western. You know, so they're all over the place. And I'm sure they exist in Massachusetts. I know they exist in Massachusetts. So anyway, she was working on this, and one of the organizations was CASA, which the Camden County CASA down here in Southern New Jersey applied for the grant. And so she brought home the materials about CASA, and I started reading that, and I said, well, I could do that. I think I'd be pretty good at it because, you know, I like talking to people, and I like, you know, like helping kids and things like that. So that's how I got involved.
So what is CASA for those of us who may not be as familiar with it? What do they do?
Yes, essentially.
What does it stand for?
It stands for Court Appointed Special Advocates. And so it's a term that is universal throughout the United States. There's CASAs in Eastern Massachusetts. There's CASAs in New Hampshire and Maine and everywhere else. In fact, there was an FBI agent who was a CASA volunteer. It's a volunteer thing. After he retired, he became a CASA volunteer up in New Hampshire, or was it Maine? One or the other. Anyway, so essentially what a CASA person does is he or she, after training by the CASA organization, is assigned to work on a case. And the case would be either a small family, a child in a family that where there's been a problems in the family, and the child is usually not with the parents, the original birth parents anymore. And the idea is to work with the court and get services for the child. And then over time, the hope is that enough can be done with the child and the family to get the two of them back together. And so that's what a CASA volunteer does, is work on cases, report to courts, testify, you know, at court hearings and things of that sort. So that's the nature of what it is.
You are listening to, I'm sorry, Peter, you have one more question.
No, go ahead, Bob. Go ahead.
Okay. You're listening to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco, and of course, my co-host is Peter Alcho. We're interviewing John Gommel, former FBI agent, private eye, teacher, reader of audiobooks. He's here with us today. And now it's time to open the floor to our listeners. So I would like to ask Nancy if there are any hands raised at this time.
We do have a few hands. Don is first.
Don from New Jersey, you're up.
Yes. So now, I'm not actually asking a question, John, but I'm going to tell you, I'm not asking a question, but I'm going to tell you something that happened. And it was so beyond anything I can remember from my boyhood, which I had my share of bullies I didn't deal with very well, but I was stuck with them. There wasn't nothing I could do about it. And I thought that was bad. But when I went to see one of my little great nieces, who at that time was maybe somewhere between 8 and 10, I don't just remember when, but she had just come home from school, and she was telling us they had done a live shooter drill in her school. And she, because apparently, because I appeared interested, she was telling me about how the teacher was demonstrating to them how the students should make themselves a small target. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, the worst I dealt with, as bad as it was getting punched around in the 70s. Nobody would have thought of bringing a gun to school. I mean, the worst it could ever get was a knife, and I never even was confronted with that. I was just, as I say, punched around, knocked down. You know, that was bad enough, but I never, you know, had to deal with what my great nieces and great nephews have had to deal with in this changed world.
John?
Is there a question? No, there's no
question, but I just want to get how different the world is from the 70s. And, you know, what children are up against compared to what I was up against in the 70s.
Well, you know, I think if you look at the, I guess the sort of the progress of the way these things have happened and what happens, you know, and people react to them. There are lots of organizations now that exist to create a better atmosphere and a better environment that will make the likelihood of those things happen like that less and less possible. And, you know, I did some work with an organization in Boston and, you know, I was doing school evaluations with that organization. And, you know, I learned about the ways in which things are done. And it's, you know, there's a dramatic amount of interest in curtailing all of that stuff now. And it's a high intensity kind of thing. It's unfortunate that it's happening, but I think to a certain extent, you know, you have to kind of like teach it in a way that you don't scare the heck out of the kids, but at least get them ready to handle an intense situation. You know, it's not easy.
You know, your organization is vital, Tatsa, because yes, I had what used to be called a nuclear family, but everybody doesn't. As I've gotten older, I know how blessed I was that I had my family. And you said yourself, you're dealing in cases where the children are not with the family for whatever reason that might be.
Thank you.
I was going to say, I haven't gotten a foot in the door yet. I mean, I've passed the background investigation. Which was not a problem, I guess. But I'm looking forward to the training because there's before I can even get assigned to a case, there's 35 hours of training that I've got to get through. So, you know, we'll see.
Thank you, Don. Thanks for your contribution.
Don. Sure.
Very good comments. Anybody else, Nancy?
Ann.
Okay, well, Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi, everybody. Hi, John. My name is Annie Chepeta. My husband is a retired Navy veteran, so go Navy. and he was also a CBP officer for 20 years. So my question for you is, first, also, thank you for working for CASA. I'm a retired family therapist and trauma counselor, and it's really important to have people like you helping people that need it at the time. Really, so good luck to you on that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Vital work. My question is, if someone were to hire a private detective, what would be your advice so they get to the right person, to an authentic person?
Well, you know, people ask me that, you know, and frankly, because I, you know lots of people who are former FBI agents who then became private investigators, you know, those are the people with whom to whom I would point if you need somebody like that. You know, I think the needs for a private investigator are, you know, I think people think they need it, but they're, you know, in many cases I was hired to do some things and I essentially talked myself out of a job, you know, because I would say what you're looking for is something that is not going to be found out. And frankly, more often than not, I had discussions with people and I said, if you had better communications with your family, you probably would not want to do what you're doing. You would probably not ask me to look into that, what you're asking me to look into. So how I tell you to look for it is to look for people who, you know, have have some expertise, and you and people will be glad to tell you what their background is. If people start looking for a former FBI person, I think that's frequently an easy way to to get past the any of the rough spots, because FBI people generally tend to be pretty ethical. That's just my view.
And how would somebody go about doing that? Like, how would, is there like a list or something? Like,
oh, well, you know, I don't know. I don't remember exactly how people would find me. I essentially made it clear to various attorneys that I knew who were doing all kinds of various kinds of like family law, so to speak, to put it mildly,
right.
Things like that. I would just make it clear that I was available. And then if they thought they could use me, I got a call. And I think I was in some sort of directory for the state of Massachusetts, and people would call me, and, you know, and what I would tell people is people wanted me to do criminal defense. And I told people, you know, I wore the white hat for all those years. I'm not about to put on a black hat. So,
right.
You know, so I think they're, I think asking if you think you need a private investigator, I would say you might want to talk, if you have a friend who's an attorney, and ask that attorney if they know people who are good at and who they'd recommend for that kind of thing. That's probably the easiest way to find it.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question. Does it matter which
right ahead.
State you would like if you're in Arizona, but you want to find somebody in a different state, where do you start? Do you start from the state that you think you'd want to look? I mean, like, can you cross state lines? How does that work?
No, well, private investigators are state licensed, you know, in each state.
Okay.
So normally you don't really find a lot of people who do a lot of cross, working. And I never knew anybody who was licensed in, let's say, all six New England states. I mean, that would be like a major expense to do that. And each state has different requirements, and, you know, it gets a little complicated. But I was only in Massachusetts. I had my Massachusetts license, and occasionally I had something that I had to do in Rhode Island. And so I would get down there and I have somebody help me out. And that's how it would work. If you needed somebody in Arizona, for example, your best bet would be to, you know, get in touch with a good private investigator, presumably in my case, I would say a former FBI agent, and say, who can you find me down in Arizona?
And I see.
That's probably okay. The best way to do that.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Annie.
Thanks, Annie.
Good job. Who's
Sharon.
Next, Nancy?
Sharon.
Sharon from Massachusetts. How are you?
Hello, Sharon.
Sharon.
I think she might be muted.
Yeah, that's okay.
There you are.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
I got myself in a loop. Thank you so much, John. This has been very interesting. My question is, have you regained since retirement a better feeling about humanity than you may have had as an FBI agent? Or does some of that kind of judgment and assessment stay with you in your daily life?
Well, no, I never developed a negative view about human beings in general. You know, essentially what I, you know, the wonderful thing about the FBI is you're not always dealing with bad guys, so to speak, or bad people, you know, not to be sexist about it, but, you know, you're not always dealing with bad people. Many of the times you're just working your way through witnesses and cases that, you know, you're finding, and you really find some really fantastic people that you get to know over the years. And even some of my informants, you know, weren't bad people, so to speak. They just were involved in bad things, and they were trying to get, you know, trying to kind of like, you know, alleviate the difficulties and things like that. And so it was my privilege to be able to work with them and get to know them and make life better for them if I could, and they would help me in my quest for finding out things. But I never developed an attitude about, you know, life is terrible and everybody's bad. You know, I never
had. I'm glad to hear it. Thank you.
Anything else, Sharon?
Oh, well, thank you, Sharon.
Okay, very good.
All
do
right,
we have
Tony.
Any more hands?
Yes, we do.
Tony.
Tony.
Hold up.
Tony.
Hey, John, I actually have a book of mine that I wrote being recorded by Perkins right now.
Ah.
So could you reflect, or can you remember, like, more on the nuts and bolts level? What, how did it all work when you were doing it? Did you go into the office, like, every day or whatever? And were you in, like, a big studio? Was it a big production? How did they actually have you guys reading the books?
Okay. Yeah, it was really quite, you know, eventually, when we ended up actually on the Perkins campus there in a building, we actually had, I think there were probably five studios in one little corridor of that building. It was a building. I can't think of the name of it, but it was, you know, I used to park and walk over to it and things like that. Long story short is I would go in and I would be working on a book. Let's say I would be assigned to do a book. And I almost always, I don't remember ever doing, maybe did one fiction book out of all the ones I had recorded over time. You know, it was most of the stuff I was recording was nonfiction. So it didn't require, you know, dramatic changes in voice and things like that. I was never one of those people that could do that kind of thing. And so I would go and I would read things, and I would go usually once a week for about 3 hours. And I'd go over there like at 9 o'clock on a Friday morning, and I'd read for 3 hours, and then I'd go back the next week at 9 o'clock on Friday and read for 3 hours. And there were people that actually listened to the book after I had recorded it, and they would find problems with my pronunciation and things like that. But I was really very good at self-correction before I did that. I would look up, you know, words which were difficult, but I was an English major in college. And so, you know, I tended to be a little bit more fastidious about, you know, getting the right pronunciation and timing and syllabication and things of that sort. So that's what it was. And then after I did all that, then it would be done into a final form, and it would go out to, you know, either to the Library of Congress or it would be available locally. So that's what I did, essentially.
On the audio now.
Did you ever listen to yourself after the production? Like, movie stars who don't like to go see themselves in the movies?
Oh yeah, no, I would listen to mine, you know, to what I had done constantly. I mean, I really got used to my own voice, you know, but you get used to that when I was a television news reporter, because, you know, you do a story on the street and you hear your voice, you know, and things of that sort. So, you know, it really became, you know, something that you got used to. Many people found it difficult to, you know, not people at Perkins. People in Perkins really adapt to that very easily, but some people can't really enjoy listening to their own voice. And I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened one time. I had a friend who lived out in central Massachusetts whose mother-in-law became essentially not able to read, and because her sight was failing, but she just couldn't. You know, she would have the large projector to read and things of that sort, but then she wasn't able to read. So eventually she started listening to Perkins books. And one day he came through the house. He lived next door to his mother-in-law, and he walked in and he said, "Where's John? I just heard his voice." And she was listening to me, you know, and so he was quite surprised at that, you know, that. But I guess it must have been realistic, because he said it sounded just like me. Oh.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
Thank you, Tony.
You're welcome.
All right,
do
Jane.
Do we have anybody else? Who?
Hi.
Jane.
Jane.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jane.
Here. Hello. I'm glad to finally have been able to jump in about 10 minutes ago. So I'm not quite sure with whom you are interviewing. What I heard was FBI, and I heard you have written a book, and I listened to Annie, you know, and some other people. So first of all, I want to know the name of the book that you are writing or have written. Is that, did I hear that correctly? And then I'll ask my other questions.
No, I have not written a book, and I am not writing.
Well, I'm putting you up there. Okay. But you are retired FBI. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I went in 1979.
Okay.
And,
so
retired in 2001.
Understood. So my concern is as our world grows more and more complicated and it's easier for people to point any judgmental part of themselves towards something. What I'm finding is that as I read more written by people who do police work or who are taking care of kids at school, you know, I'm understanding more how complex the situation is, and it would make me want to give up. What is it that you think is the most productive and constructive information for people who are involved in police work? I just read the book called The Unit, and I was profoundly impressed by the people defined and described in that book who did the work of immigrating from one country to another so that they could integrate themselves into the problem areas and get the bad situations addressed. And I'm really wondering what you recommend as the best procedure to do that here in this country.
I guess there's so many different, when you asked it in that particular way, there are so many different levels of law enforcement activity in the United States. I mean, there are probably, you know, so many different, just in the Boston area alone, you know, you've got local police, you've got, you know, the FBI, you've got the DEA, you've got, you know, the state police, you've got all of these different things, and everyone has a different kind of job that they have to do. Some are more, I guess you would say, cerebral than others. Some are more physical than others. And, you know, I guess the difficulty is you can't really prescribe, you know, activities for people to follow, to follow a law enforcement career, so to speak. You know, you could start in one kind of job and then go to another. I mean, the range of things you can work on as an FBI agent are pretty dramatic. And a local police officer also has a dramatic range of things that he or she has to deal with. You know, and it's just, you just can't really kind of put your finger on it. I think one of the problems that is facing law enforcement right now is that police work, because of the proliferation of firearms, has become become a pretty dangerous, I mean, especially local police. I mean, the FBI, we essentially took control of situations and we essentially did things. But when a local police officer and he or she walks into an apartment building and knocks on a door and, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. And that's the kind of thing that's very difficult to, they're difficult to kind of like envision how you could prepare yourself for that. So I don't know the answer for that.
So can you recommend a couple of books that you believe really reveal the complexities of what policing has to do today? And I heard you mention something about doing a 35-hour training, or was that a different voice?
That's CASA. That's a different.
Okay, I'm sorry. I goofed.
Yeah, that's okay.
Can you recommend, you know, any books? Really recommend. I just want to be able to have more confidence and more information than I feel that I do right now about how to support our policing.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry I can't give you an answer because I really, you know, I think one of the problems with being in police work or law enforcement is that you don't really read novels about it and books. About, you know,
well, I'm not necessarily novels, but I just, it was worth asking. So I'll keep asking and keep reading and looking it through.
Sorry, I don't have an answer for you.
Well, that is an answer though. That tells me to keep open and keep looking and reading. So I will.
Thanks, James.
We have about one minute to go in our program. We may have time for one more quick comment from anybody. I don't know if anybody's.
Yes, Nora has her hand up and she's the last
Nora,
one.
Nora, you have about a minute. Go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you. When you are working at an FBI, were you visually impaired or blind at that time or become blind afterwards?
Was I what at that time?
Were you blind or visually impaired at the time when you were hired as an FBI agent?
He's sighted. Nora, he's sighted. He's a reader of audiobooks.
I didn't realize. Thank you.
You're welcome, Nora. Thank you. Thank you. John, you've been very successful and you've done a lot of, and we're really very grateful to you for your service. You did your job protecting us back in the day and reading for us, and you provide very good services for the people, and we appreciate you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
And it's a pleasure having you. We'd like to have you back on the show at some point in the future, but for now, let me thank you very much for being here today and taking the time to share your experiences with us.
Well, you're certainly welcome. It was great working on the Perkins recording situation. And then of course I had the privilege of being an FBI agent for 22 years and that was just the best thing you ever could have.
Thanks, John.
Well, thank you so much and thank you. Everybody else for your participation on In Perspective today. I'm Bob Branco. Go safe with God's abundant blessings and have a great week, everybody, and happy summer.